The song has invited us to go back to our roots so that our collective energy and mindfulness will bring us together as an organism, flowing as a river with none of our separation. The whole sun to breathe as one body, generate peace as one body, be free as one body. Let us transcend the boundaries of the delusive self, liberating from the superiority complex, the inferiority complex, and the equality complex.
So welcome everyone, and thank you for coming on this holiday weekend. Tonight we were going to talk somewhat about the Eightfold Path that Sangha here has been looking at for the past month or so. But let me say before we begin something about loving kindness that Fran involved us in. Please understand that loving kindness is not a even though we did it as a meditation tonight, it is not a meditation. It is a description of the heart that one is living from in one's life. And in the same way that tonight we practice mindfulness of sitting and breathing and body and walking as a formal practice, meditative practice, it's not that. It is learning how to be mindful, how to be present in one's life. If we only learn how to be mindful when we come once a week to meditation, or if we only learn how to be mindful when we're sitting on our cushion, it will be a very limited benefit to us. And the Buddha never meant it any other way than that. The cultivation of mindfulness, of learning to live in the present moment, which really means to live in reality, is something we need. It's a necessity to cultivate throughout our life. If we are to have the capacity to have a healthy mind, in the same way that we know that the necessity of eating right, eating healthily, eating nutritionally, giving the body exercise, getting a good night's sleep, etc., etc. In the same way, you know, we know that these are necessary if one is to have more or less a healthy body. Right? And again, if that is really something we want, it's not something we do one day a week, is it? It's not something we do one meal a day. It's not something we do one week out of the month. It's something we have to do on an ongoing basis if we're really committed to having a healthy body so we can enjoy our life. We know that a healthy body is a necessity so what we put in it and how we treat it, etc., is a necessity for a healthy body. In the same way, unfortunately, much less in our society is known about having a healthy mind. We're much better at having a healthy body. And that could also be because we are a society which puts more emphasis on the body than it does on the health of the mind, the well-being of the mind. For that, we've often had to look like we are doing now. We're looking to those practices and those traditions in our human world that have spent time and energy trying to understand the mind and trying to understand what is a healthy mind and what nurtures a healthy mind. In this case, I'm talking what I'm familiar with, which is Buddhism, which has been looking at these matters of the mind for over 2,500 years and has come up with many conclusions, many teachings and practices, of which mindfulness, the capacity to live in the now, the capacity to live in the present moment, the capacity to see objectively what is going on in the sphere of our body, in the sphere of our sensations, feelings, in the sphere of our thoughts and mind, and in the sphere of how we're perceiving things around us. If we cannot see that clearly, it's very difficult to make good choices, a wise decision to know what to do. So mindfulness has a mind training, and it is considered within Buddhism an essential training of the mind. While there are other trainings having to do with concentration, developing insight, etc., mindfulness is the foundation. And the other foundation is what we did in the loving kindness or metta meditation. Because mindfulness is not enough. Because as you know, as human beings, we spend much of our life in interaction, in relationship, right? To ourselves, to our family, to our friends, to our colleagues, to our neighbors, to society. I mean, we are always, unless we are a hermit, we are always, again, I was looking around the room, we seem to be mostly what are called lay people. So we have lives. And so, how do we relate to one another? How do we relate to one another in a way that causes the least suffering to one another, and at the same time actually contributes to well-being? And for that, the Buddha highly instructed his disciples to practice many things. So, like a foundation thing is loving kindness, right? Or another way that's often translated, which is friendliness. Now, friendliness can sound a little superficial, but I think it's quite profound. Friendliness does not mean we put a smile on our face and we're just kind of friendly with everybody. Hi, how you doing? You know, waving. There are people who always just wave to everybody. It doesn't mean that. It means that that those qualities that exist in true friendship, caring about another human being, wanting only good things to happen to them, not wanting bad things to happen to them, being there for others, being supportive, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So if you think about all those qualities that exist naturally, often, and spontaneously, in true friendships, the Buddha recommended that this be the way we relate to one another, totally, non-discriminatively. Which is very hard for most of us, because again, most of us are so conditioned to kind of open our heart to very few. Right? I mean, most of us, I think if we're honest, we would say the number of people that I truly generate all those qualities of friendship to, and really embrace and really care about, and spontaneously when I'm with them, I'm happy to be with them, I'm open-hearted, etc., are very few. Now, whether that's, it's very few because we don't know better. We've never really been taught that the heart has much greater capacity than we believe. So maybe we haven't been taught. Or maybe for many of us, somehow along the line, we have been wounded in our heart. So it is somewhat, there's kind of a wall around it, or a barrier around it, or it feels quite limited, right, in its capacity to be present to everyone. So there's lots of reasons, but the bottom line, these reasons are artificial. Because the truth is, metta, or the description of this loving heart, is the natural heart. It's not something, the reason we're having to kind of manufacture it is because we are so forgotten, we have so forgotten it, right? So we have to kind of open those channels. But we know, I went to the beach today, and on the tram in front, there was this child. And then you know how the parent holds the child who's sitting behind. And the child looks, and just this big smile comes up on the child's face. Right? Didn't know me from Adam. Didn't know whether I was a good person or a bad person. And yet its first response upon seeing me was smile. I think that is an indication that we all come into that world with that unbounded open heart. And again, along the way, through all kinds of causes and conditions, it may get skewed, it may shut down, etc. But it is the natural condition. Because in truth, when we look at another, we see ourselves. We see our own face. And we should be happy to see it. Right. In the same way that most of us unselfishly, want ourselves not to suffer. Right? Most of us unselfishly want our body and mind to be good, to be healthy, to be happy. I'm quite not able to actually follow through in it, but it is the wish of most of us. Most of us want things to work out in our lives. Most of us want ourselves to be happy. Most of us want our bodies to be free of pain and sickness, right? It's not something we have to work at. Most of us, if we're not too screwed up, we kind of naturally have that good wishes toward ourselves, don't we? It's not something we have to manufacture. So in the same way, when one begins to break down the narrowness of view that only perceives myself as the only worthy one of happiness, which I think most would grant is a very selfish view, isn't it? Right? To only care about my own well-being and not to care about anybody else's well-being. Right? To only be totally self-centered without noticing like there are many more of you than me in this room, right? And for me only to care about my own well-being and not to care about your well-being would be incredibly self-centered and selfish, wouldn't it? But also there is a more fundamental issue, which is it is very difficult if you're all in misery and running amok in this world creating misery. It's very happy for me to be happy. Very difficult, right? So once I understand that, I understand that our happiness, or even my happiness, is conditioned on life a lot on the happiness of others. So for this reason, and many other reasons, such as usually when you have a loving, open heart, you're happy. You feel better, right? Than if you feel very closed off or actually have a lot of negative thoughts toward other people. So, again, I strongly recommend that the cultivation of loving kindness like the cultivation of mindfulness, really become the basis of your life. You know, how do you relate to everyone you encounter? Offer them friendship. But you may say, yeah, but you know, there are a lot of people who aren't that wonderful, that aren't that nice. Right, but the truth is, I would imagine that some of your friends are the same way, and yet you offer them friendship. Right? I would imagine there are people in your family who are not the who are not saints, and yet you offer them friendship, you offer them understanding, you offer them acceptance. So again, in that same model, if you kind of begin to, as the Buddha did, as bodhisattvas do, which is to see all human beings as their family. Right? Which means we understand there is relationship among all of us. So therefore, when we encounter each other, we can say we are encountering someone in our family. So if we think we're encountering someone in our family, we pay closer attention to them. We're more attentive to them. So again, these practices that we did tonight on a formal basis of mindfulness of breath, mindfulness of walking, mindfulness of the body, etc., and the practice of loving kindness, please don't see them as, you know, in and of themselves meditation practices. See them as ways of training the heart and mind so we can be healthy. And I think we do want to be healthy. And unfortunately, even if we spend lots of energy developing the capacity to have a healthy body, if we don't have a healthy mind, we will not be happy. We will not feel good. We will not be at ease. So please understand that the practices we do here have a lot, are as essential as our gym workouts, if not more so. Any questions about what I just talked about in terms of the practices of mindfulness and the practice of loving kindness? As really kind of foundation practices. Yes. I'm just moving over from your left. The purpose of walking meditation, going back to the time of the Buddha, right, in the practice of mindfulness, he taught his disciples basically mindfulness of four postures, right? Lying down, sitting up, standing and walking. But basically, if you think about it, those are the positions our body takes. So basically, when we are practicing mindful walking, we are practicing learning to maintain mindfulness while moving. No, I mean, again, when we do it in a formal setting like this, it's probably good that we all kind of do it together in different groups so we don't bump into each other, etc., etc. And again, if you go around in different Buddhist groups, you'll find out some do it fast, some do it slow, some do it put their hands this way. But the bottom line is, well, if you're asking what it's really about, it's really about, you know, how can I learn to move around in this world, maintaining awareness of the body, right? Again, so again, in terms of you know, mindfulness and daily life practices, which we're cultivating, it's good to know that. Oh, I don't just have to practice mindfulness when I'm sitting down. I can practice mindfulness when I'm walking around in public. I can practice mindfulness when I'm walking in the parking lot to my car. I can practice mindfulness when I go on a walk, you know, with my dog, or, you know, that, so in movement, I can practice when I'm at work and I'm moving, you know, around at work. I can be aware that I'm moving. I can feel I'm stepping. And that has the capacity of bringing us back to the present moment, right? Rather than getting lost in thought. So walking meditation is a wonderful practice, and for people, often people who find the sitting meditation difficult, it's good to alternate. And again, traditionally, we start out in sitting meditation and then go to walking meditation. Part of that, I think, is also because the sitting meditation is often difficult physically for people, so it's good to alternate it with the walking. But there's no reason on your own that you couldn't do your walking meditation first, if that really quiets you down and centers you, and then go into sitting meditation. Okay? Thank you. Any other questions about the practice of mindfulness or the practice of loving kindness? Yes.
Talking about mindfulness.
Mm-hmm.
Leave the drama at the door. In my case, I try it, and it feels easier said than done.
You've noticed that. Yeah. Oh, yeah, no, no, it's good. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. Okay. So, what's your name again? I say every time. Your name is? Bart. That's right. B-A-R-T. Bart. So, Bart really caught me. Because he realized it is much easier to teach Dharma than to practice Dharma. And you are absolutely right. Again, intention. Right? So having a correct intention is important. Because again, most people, the idea of leaving their drama behind is a new concept. Right? Most people think life is drama. Right? And totally lost in the drama, thinking about the drama, stirred up emotionally about the drama, talking about the drama, is what life's about. Right? That's called ordinary life, drama. So, coming in here, or sitting in your meditation, and setting the intention, right, not to get caught up in the drama, is giving you a different baseline than daily life. Okay? So, that's the important thing. That's why I said, don't just sit down on your cushion. Sit down with your cushion and take a few moments before you begin your meditation, setting your intention, being clear about what your meditation practice is, being clear about how you're going to handle thoughts, etc., how you're going to handle drama. Right. It's important because you're setting a different touchstone. Now, as you say, which, you know, this practice takes time. So, but even right from the beginning, you can set the correct intention. So like Bart says, having sat down, set the correct intention to leave the drama behind, lo and behold, 2 minutes later, it shows up. It's not a big deal. It shows up because it's used to showing up. Right? Now, you know, again, I said it before, I'll say it again, practice begins with second thought. Practice does not begin with first thought. First thought means what arises spontaneously, naturally in the mind, right? What you're saying. Okay? The drama arises, whatever the drama is. Now. You can't stop that. You can't prevent that. You're not trying. The question is, at that point, what do you do? That's what practice means. Now, it could be, you know, and again, this is a developmental model, which means it takes time. Right? Obviously, if you ask me what the practice is you would be aware that the drama is arisen, you would see it for what it is, you would just let it go, and you'd come back to the breath. Right? That's the practice. Now, let's say in the past, when the drama arose in Bart, he didn't realize it was drama until 3 days later. All right? All of a sudden, he kind of comes down and goes, wow, have I been caught up in something? All right? So maybe Bart now catches it in 30 minutes. You know what I'd say? He's doing better. So please, in your practice, while we are diligent, we also have understanding. So just do your best. You know, the key thing is whenever you, you know, one of the translations of the French word for mindfulness is remembering. Remembering. Oh. You know? Heart's lost in his drama, and also he remembers. I'm supposed to be practicing mindfulness of the breath, right? Oh. He drops it. That's good. He's practicing mindfulness. He's remembering where he is and what he's supposed to be doing. Or else, you know, he becomes aware, I'm just going down that road of drama again. And he just says drama. And he stops right there. See, that's a great thing. Most people, even when they see it, they can't stop. Right? Even though we run down that road of fear or anger or resentment or sadness or, you know, all the stories, right? Even though we've run down them endless times, it's like, you know, we're a dog with a bone. We cannot stop chewing on it. Right? But anybody who's trained their dog knows what. If you can train a dog for what? Put it down. And a well-trained dog will what? Put it down. Now, a dog can do that. There's something it really loves. I mean, you know, please understand, you can train a dog. A dog, this is not a highly developed being. Right? To put down something that it loves. That its now whole natural instinct is to what? Hold on to. Right? Much more. Now, a bone is something they enjoy. Most of our drama, when we're objective about it, we would go, no, I really don't find it that enjoyable to be angry. Right? You know, to just mull over stuff, painful things from the past. You know what I mean? Yeah, right? When we're objective, we go, no. Right? This is not bringing me happiness. This is not bringing me ease. And yet what? We can't just drop it. So what we want to learn is to drop it. Right? And whether it becomes a behavioral response, just, you know, that we're training ourselves in this way over time, as our practice deepens, we really understand the nature of drama and thoughts at a much more profound level, so we understand their nature, so therefore we don't get involved in it. Those are just different levels of practice. All right? So, you know, just don't make it a big deal. You know? Don't make practice something like, you know, you gotta be successful at. Like it's a thing that can be quantified. Right? It's a process. And just beginning to be able to see how drama arises in your life and how it's self-created. It's not outside, it's inside. Right? And to be able to see how it is causing you to suffer. Right? And not freeing you from suffering. You know, on the way to enlightenment, on the way to pure mindfulness and deep concentration, you're going to learn a lot more. Right? And that learning is wisdom. So don't, you know, it's important that we see practice in a bigger way of transformation rather than, you know, just, you know, becoming good at certain meditative skills. Does that make sense? You know, you don't want to kind of make it like a mechanistic thing. Right, because you could be a very good meditator and you could have great mindfulness and concentration and yet still be a complete jerk. Right? You know, still be a complete egoist. Right? You're just a very good meditator and you've got good mindfulness. So, please understand that. That's why, again, these practices of loving kindness, these practices of compassion, these practices of selflessness are so important too. It's a process of which mindfulness, concentration, mind training. I mean, as and Andy's been working with you, I know in the Eightfold Path, we see that you know, those parts of the Eightfold Path that deal with mind training are only part of the Eightfold Path. There are other parts that deal with how we conduct ourselves. There are other parts that deal with livelihood. There are other parts that deal with communication and speech. So the mind training is just part of a bigger transformation. So before we go on to deal with the Eightfold Path, are there any more questions about mindfulness? And yes.
So you were speaking about the intention that informs our practice in meditation. You sort of de-emphasized that as the meditating for insight. In terms of contrast to that, with mindfulness, I'm not sure of the distinction, because one of my intentions in meditating, aside from contemplating some measure of concentration and peace, is to get insight as to what lies behind what I am experiencing, what is present within my inner world. So just coming along the relationship.
Okay. I didn't mean to. I don't know what I said that gave you that impression. But I was really just talking about what we did here today.
Yes.
Foundation practices of mindfulness and loving kindness as foundation. But you're absolutely right in terms of the process of the path, concentration and fundamentally wisdom, which is developing insight, understanding, and I'll talk about that in a minute in terms of the Eightfold Path, is essential. Okay. But again, and maybe this is a good segue into the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path, mindfulness as a foundation is essential, or we can't do anything. Right? Because even if you think of practices of insight, right? If we're not capable of focusing the mind, if we're not capable of being mindful of thoughts, feelings, perceptions that are arising within us, not being able to concentrate on a certain pattern or whatever that we want to explore, our capacity to gain any ground will be impossible, because the example is, if the room is dark and you want to find something, if you can't hold the light steady, it's going like this, you'll never be able to look and see. So the practice of mindfulness and concentration is essential for really developing a penetrative insight. So I didn't mean to say that they were different. They really kind of embrace one another. But I was just saying, in terms of what we were doing tonight, as sort of a foundation, the mindfulness and loving kindness are kind of foundation practices. Okay. But let me just use that, what your question you said, to talk a little about, and again, I know you've been talking about four of the eight, but I want to go back a little bit and just talk about the Four Noble Truths. Did you talk about the Four Noble Truths? You did. Is everybody familiar with the Four Noble Truths? Ad nauseum or something, you talked about the Four Noble Truths? Everybody sick of the Four Noble Truths? Oh, you went to a good. Is everybody familiar with the Four Noble Truths? No. Oh, good. I love that. So this is something very important. Because life, the loving kindness, meditation, Four Noble Truths, Eightfold Path, it becomes like catechism. Buddhism, Buddhist, and people can repeat it. It's not something to be repeated. It's something to be lived. So to me, while the Buddha and Buddhism over 2,500 years has developed quite a wonderful capacity to generate practical, incisive, insightful practices and teachings for all kinds of situations and for all kinds of people, I think it's always important that we go back to the human experience and presentation of the Buddha, Shakyamuni, and especially his first teaching. I always have found great meaning in that first world wheel turning, what it's called, that he did, because this was his first teaching that he gave after his great enlightenment, which is very interesting. You know, we know that he, after many years of acquainting himself with the various meditative practices and teachings that were most dominant in the spiritual field of northern India of his time, he eventually went his own way, feeling that none of what was being offered really resolved the deep questions that he had about life and suffering. And so, again, he went through his own meditative search, which resulted in his great enlightenment under the Bodhi tree in Bodh Gaya in India. And then we know he spent many, many weeks in rapture, you know, like somebody who'd been in maximum security prison for 30 years and they were released. And it was a beautiful day. You could just imagine, you know, for weeks and weeks and weeks, somebody who had been in prison, how they would just revel in their freedom, right? And how everything was just so precious. So we know that the Buddha spent many, many weeks in that kind of post-enlightenment rapture. And then, you know, there are different stories, but at some point he decided he would teach, even though he was very concerned that most beings were too involved in the drama to be interested in his dharma. But he did. And then he again, I think it's meaningful that he, at least for me, that when he began teaching, the first people he taught were these group of four or five men who had been involved in his ascetic period. You know, they'd been practicing extreme self-mortification, asceticism, as a path to enlightenment. When the Buddha saw that was only just even more suffering and no great enlightenment, for those of you who know his story, they left it. You know, it's like he had punked out or something. He had whisked out. And they had kind of, you know, walked away from him in disgust. Which again, you know, we can take it like a story, but I would imagine emotionally, you know, we can imagine he was a human being. So these were his closest buddies, you know, these were his dharma buddies. And they were all practicing together. And he had come to the conclusion. I mean, so again, it gives you a sense of the inner strength and surety of him as a human being. You know, so even though he was practicing something that was accepted as a path to enlightenment, and even though his closest friends were all practicing it, when he came to the conclusion, guys, it's not working. Right? He knew when he gave them that message that meant that what? They wanted to end they ended the relationship with him. He was alone. Right? Not only had he gone through all the major meditative schools and teachers of his time, and had really in all of them kind of been the A student, and the teacher had said, come teach with me and all that. He had walked away, so he had kind of walked himself into a place of great aloneness. If he's with his last friends, and he, because of his own inner search for truth, and I think his own inner authenticity. You know, he knew that he would not be satisfied with anything short of the answer to his deepest questions. So again, he went off his own. We know it was only a very kind young woman who was tending the cows of her family that offered him some food and sustenance that he could nurse himself back to health before he involved himself in meditation again. So again, after his great enlightenment and his post-enlightenment bliss, and he decided to teach, he thought, I will teach them. I will bring this message, this experience of liberation and freedom to these five Dharma friends of mine. And so we know he walked from Bodhaya to the Deer Park in Sarnath, which is a long walk. It took him days. But that's where he went because he knew that's where they had gone to practice. And what is considered his first teaching that he gave at Deer Park was this teaching on the Four Noble Truths, which include the Eightfold Path. So again, I think this is very germane that this is what he wanted to share. He could have shared lots of things, but he wanted to share this one. So let me just say something about the Four Noble Truths, not as a catechism, not as a syllogism, but as something that is very has to be personally meaningful. Again, I think it's important when one embarks on a religious or spiritual path that one feel a connection kind of with the life story of the founder. Right? And that one understands it in a very human way. Because we are humans. And we relate very much in this personal way. So again, without going into the life of the Buddha, we know that it was only, and again, the first noble truth is suffering, dukkha. And we only know that his kind of shift in life, his shift in value, his shift in purpose, his shift in what he was doing, came about when he encountered suffering. It was not when he encountered fun. It was not when he encountered good times. It was not when he encountered success. Right? Those weren't the things, right, that motivated him to look more deeply into life. It was only when he saw the underbelly, when he saw the other side, and he was willing to look at that openly and honestly, that change occurred. And again, we know in the parables that, you know, what his encounters were was with a sick person, an aging person, and a dead person, right? And again, there's a lot more that can be said, and I'm sure his experience was a lot deeper than that. But that basically, he saw that all the things that he enjoyed were all time limited and were all subject to change. You know, and that was we know that that was again, if you could imagine, that was a shock to him because he had lived in this dream world of being young and healthy, and everything was good, and, right? Everything would always work, and right? It'd just go on forever. The party would never end, right? And so and the interesting thing is, the fourth experience was he saw a hermit, or he saw some kind of practitioner, or we could say he saw a human being that generated. Just from when he saw them, just the way the person was walking and the way the person looked, the person seemed to have radiated a great peace, a great ease. Right? And we know that when he asked his charioteer, who is that? What is that? Because he'd always lived in the palace, He always lived among a finery, right, and ease. He lived in Naples, I'm not sure. Something like that. So he was surprised when he saw this, and again, I think it's instrumental that this is the fourth experience and not the first experience. Because I think if he had seen that hermit first, he would have got, you know, who's that guy? How can he dress like that? You know? But it was after these other experiences of seeing sickness, old age, and death, and seeing the people involved in that, that when he saw this person, who walked with this great ease and peacefulness and sort of joy in his face, and was just, you know, just had on one robe, right, and a walking staff, right? And when he asked the chariot, you know, like, who's that? Right? And the chariot said, oh, well, he's a hermit, you know, he's somebody that devotes himself to meditation. You know, well, where does he live? Well, he doesn't live anywhere. You know, he wanders around, he just lives wherever he takes him. Well, you know, well, where's his food? Oh, well, he begs for his food, he depends on other people. You know, the Buddha was kind of blown away, I think. Right? You see what I'm saying? He was blown away. Because he thought up to then, happiness had to do with status, happiness had to do with things, happiness had to do with sensuality and pleasure and fulfillment. You know, that's what happiness was all about. And so he was kind of dumbstruck. When he saw not only the impermanence and the conditionality of all the things he based his happiness on, but when he saw that he was somebody who had none of that, and they seemed to be happy. And we know that after that those experiences, when the Buddha returned to his palace and tried to resume his normal life, you know, as the prince, as the husband, as the father, as the, you know, all that stuff, he couldn't do it. It's interesting, he just couldn't do it. Because he knew there was something more to life. But he didn't, you know, it wasn't available to him. So for him, he had to leave the palace, begin to search, leave some great enlightenment. We talked about his great rapture, and now he's what? He's walked to the deer path. And there are his five disciples. And now, they were sort of working disciples. He was kind of the head man of the five of them. I mean, they were all equals, but he was sort of like, he was the most extreme. Right, so that's another reason when he kind of turned his way, they were just shocked. So the interesting thing is, we know that, according to the accounts, that when they saw him from a distance, it was sort of like, oh, there's that loser, Siddhartha, you know? There's that guy, he's probably just coming here to beg us to take him back, right? It was probably something like that when they saw him. And yet, according to the accounts, of course, these are the Buddhist accounts, that when he got closer, I think like the Buddha when he saw that hermit, when they got closer, he was different. There was a light coming from him, right? And the way he walked and the way he was, they could tell. So by the time he actually got to them, even though when he was at a distance, they were kind of going, you know, when he gets here, we'll tell him what we really think of him. Or by the time they got there, they realized that he was different than he had been. So then he begins to teach them, right? And we know he teaches them the Four Noble Truths. Let me just say a few words about this, because I think again that for each of us, this is, you know, we talked about the foundation, like mindfulness and loving kindness. The first noble truth is there is suffering. I think it is impossible to have a meaningful spiritual life unless one truly, openly is willing to encounter one's own personal suffering in this life and the suffering of the world. Right? And to do that just very openly and acceptingly, to acknowledge that. Somehow, in this world, there's a culture that exists in our country where you're supposed to be happy. You're supposed to be successful. Everything's, you know, how's everything? What do you say? Everything's great. Right? I mean, that's the way, you know. Right? No matter if it's a mess. How are you doing? Great, everything's fine. You know, I mean, that's That's the veneer that we're sort of trained to put on life. Right? And again, it doesn't mean that there aren't times when things are great and so on, things aren't working in our life. It doesn't deny any of this. But at the same time, if we are honest, as we look at our whole life, and if maybe our life has been blessed, if we look around the world, we look around our fellow beings, our family, our friends, society, the world, we cannot help but see that suffering is a predominant condition of human life. Whether it's the suffering that's very physical, like the suffering of poverty, the suffering of the natural disasters, the unnatural disasters, the suffering, of lack of shelter, et cetera, those kind of heavy sufferings, or whether on the other side it's the self-induced suffering, the self-created suffering of depression and anxiety and loneliness and anger and resentment and hatred and power and all the sufferings that are created by the mind, the different violence. Right? We cannot help but see that suffering is a fundamental condition of this human life, which means my life, your life, our family's life, our parents' life, our grandparents', you know what I mean? Our children's life. No matter what we want, so many parents, the realization that they cannot protect their children from suffering is like a big one. So anyhow, I encourage all of us to follow the Buddha's example and to acknowledge dukkha. And suffering, dukkha, it doesn't just mean like gross suffering, it really means dissatisfaction. It means unsatisfactoriness of life. And even when we succeed, that even when things are working, there is an unraveling. That even when we are, things are going well, there may be parts of us that are still feeling disconnected, alone, alienated, separated. I won't spend too much time on it, but there's many multiple levels of this Buddhist word, dukkha. And many call it, right? So, the encounter with suffering, the personal encounter with suffering, is something we all have to come to terms with. It will motivate us like it motivated the Buddha. The Buddha was not motivated to free himself from suffering from reading a book, from hearing a talk. That does not do it. The Buddha had a very personal encounter with suffering that shook him up. Right? He hit bottom. And he was willing to acknowledge that. Now, that could be pretty miserable if it was left at that. Luckily, there's the second noble truth, which is the Buddha looked at causation. All right, there is all this suffering. What's causing it? Right? So there is this capacity now to use this great gift of our mind, right? See, Barb, when our mind is consumed with drama and emotionality, it's a source of suffering to us. But yet our mind has this great capacity of insight. Right? I mean, of looking at that situation that's causing you suffering and going, what's really causing that? What's causing me to suffer? What's causing suffering to exist in this situation or relationship? Right? So the capacity to bring forth the second noble truth, to look deeply into the cause of suffering, my own personal suffering, right? Suffering in relationships, suffering in the world. Right? There's much suffering in the world. What's causing it? We need to look deeply. We can't just throw money at it, we can't just throw solutions at it, because we first need to what? What's really causing it? And not just at a superficial level, but a deep level. And then we have the capacity of what? Ending the suffering. Third noble truth. Ending suffering. Cessation of suffering is nirvana. It is not an altered state. Nirvana is not an altered state. It's not a state. It is when one has freed oneself from the causes of suffering. One has achieved Nirvana. And there is an intrinsic well-being and happiness when that occurs. And the fourth noble truth, which the Sangha here has been looking at, is that Eightfold Path that the Buddha elaborated there in his first teaching in a realistic and practical way, accomplish that cessation of suffering. Again, please do not take this as a story. Please do not take this as a catechism or religious dogma or anything. The Four Noble Truths need to be something that we live. We are willing, we are no longer going to wall ourselves off from suffering, we're no longer going to be in denial, we're no longer going to pretend, or we're no longer going to suffer from needlessly. We are going to look deeply at the nature of suffering within ourselves and others, right? We're going to understand the causes of them, and when we understand the causes, we are understanding what no longer to do in the actions of our body, in the actions of our speech, in the actions of our mind and thoughts. Right? We can free ourselves from that. As well, we have the capacity, like in our practice of loving kindness, six paramitas, other kinds of practices, we learn that we have the capacity, because of this unfixed nature of it, that we can do it differently, right? You know, once I understand that putting my finger on top of the nail is the reason I keep hitting my finger, right? The cause of my suffering, I can walk. I can learn how to hold the nail. I can learn how to hammer correctly, so hammering becomes something beneficial and useful and no longer a source of suffering to me. Once I learn by the practice of meditation to observe my mind, to observe my thoughts, to observe my emotional reactions, to observe the effects that my actions and my words have on my own mind state and on others, right? Mindfulness reveals that. Then I have the capacity of changing, stopping some, starting some new ones. I have the capacity of truly reducing the suffering that I am creating for myself and others. Again, the reason that we don't have to do it alone, but that we can follow a spiritual path. Again, Buddhism is a wonderful path. It's my path. There are other paths. But I think it's important to have a path. Mm-hmm. Because there is in other words, we don't have to at that point, do it all on by ourselves. There is a great stream of human experience, there's a great stream of human knowledge about healing and transformation, about awakening, about liberation, right, that is available to us. To each of us. And that if we follow it, right, we will achieve it. Of that there is no doubt, because it has been done for 2,500 years by people just like us. The only thing is, you know, are we willing to stop the games, to stop the denial, and to encounter deeply the nature of our own personal suffering, the suffering of those around us, and just using our own capacity for deep looking to understand causation, what's causing this suffering, what's causing me to suffer, what's causing her to suffer, what's causing us to suffer. and then to be courageous enough to do it differently. And if you can't do it differently, at least stop doing what you're doing. You know? Have enough sense, you know what I mean? If I haven't learned how to correctly hold a hammer, I can at least stop hammering. I mean, we laugh because you go, of course, it sounds so simple. And yet, if you look at your life and your relationships and everything, you see, right, the thumb's there and the hammer keeps coming down on it. And then we go, I can't believe you. My thumb is still hurting. Right? But if we stop, we see who's holding the hammer. It's right here. So I'm happy that you're studying the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. And again, hopefully that study is not an intellectual, but it's experiential. Because the Buddha said, I teach only one thing, the cessation of suffering. Right? And even though his teachings have been elaborated and written upon and turned into philosophies and psychologies and debated, I think the Buddha himself was not like that. The Buddha said, I teach only the cessation of suffering. If you want to talk to me, let's talk about your suffering and how you can be free of it. That's what he, you know, if you read his dialogue with all kinds of people who came to him, that was the essential dialogue. Many different types of people, monks, nuns, laymen, lay people, young, old, rich, poor, you know, all kinds of people. But you can always see in all his dialogues, he had one purpose. How can I help free this person from their suffering? Right. So, okay. Thank you for listening.
We will have a full day of mind course on August 6th, and Fred will be here to give a Dharma talk. The day of mind course, and that will be at Yolanda Becker's Inner Light Center, which is off of Logan. There was an email that went out, I believe it was past Friday or Saturday, about that. So you can sign up on the website. We do need to have an